Thank you very much. I don't know if you can believe everything that Ken says there, and particularly what he says about Concordia. Nothing good came out of it. He came out of it, and I know there's many others. I didn't say that, so don't carry his words too far. But I appreciate Ken's enthusiasm, and perhaps we could just go home now after an advertisement about Israel like that. You only have a few moments this evening. You're very busy people. Some of you are students. You're working hard on exams. Other of you are profs, and you're working harder on the exams than the students are. I'm sure you students who are here. Wait till you get to the other side and start making exams and correcting them, and then you'll see there's two sides to that coin. At any rate, I don't want to take a great deal of your time, but I would like to share some things which I feel are really basic. The first thing I tell students, I didn't remember saying that first, but I guess I did, but the first number of things I tell students, number one, the Bible, without the land and its historical, geographical setting, without time and space, is really not the Bible as we know the Bible. The Bible is not maybe land, somewhere, someplace, sometime. The Bible is a real place with real people, and in that respect, we know that we who take the Bible seriously cannot take it without the historical, geographical context in which the Bible was given. Perhaps I can just walk up here. I don't know how far this cord will go. The second side of the coin, however, is that we do not worship that context. We do not worship geography. We do not go to holy places because there really is no holy place. There is one holy God. And therefore, we have to be extremely careful while using the context not to worship that context. And you'll see lots of people in Jerusalem worshiping that context. Jerusalem is a fetish. And it's a fetish which we try to get away from. The last thing I try to do with the students is we're looking over Jerusalem. And they're all stirred and they've seen the country. And we've gone over Amos and David and we've pulled everything together. And we sit at a place or stand, or try to anyway, we have time, and look over the city. I said, now where is the most important piece of real estate in all of God's priorities? And of course they say, there it is, Jerusalem. No, you've missed the whole point. And then they start to think, and they think no. And I ask them, where is God building his temple? And of course there's always those among our number who have it all worked out very nicely. They'll take a chart and show you. And they immediately answer, oh, right over there. I said, you've missed the point. God is building his temple in you. And you have a job to do. And I try to point them away from the physical surroundings. And in fact, I tell them the most important thing you could learn in coming to Jerusalem is that you didn't have to come in the first place to be any better Christian, any more spiritual Christian. But you came to find things which you can use in a biblical, in a better biblical interpretation of the text, of the context. I like to use the example. If we had trains, I know your train station here is a little defunct, but say you still had trains in St. Louis. And if you found a text in 4000 A.D., and that text came from, say, November 1980, and that text said Bill Anderson no longer drove his 8-cylinder Lincoln Continental to Chicago for board meetings, he took the train. Okay, and you could exegete that, and I was a biblical language major in seminary, and we could say William, well, the two L's, there's a connection between William and Bill. Ander had a son, Lincoln, something about a president of the United States, and they have built cars also. We could go all down kinds of roads, and it would be most of the information was extremely important, and we could really gain a great deal from carefully treating that text in isolation. But if we were able to put as a background of that text, 1980, November, presidential elections, the price of gas, inflation, Iraq, Iran, the Israel-Arab crisis, all of the material that you know because you live now, then you say, a light would come on. You say, now I see why Bill Anderson didn't drive his car. It was too expensive. And the whole bit that you know surrounds that text. And all we are trying to do at the Institute of Holy Land Studies is simply provide that backdrop, not because we worship that backdrop, nor the land, nor the people, nor any other part of the backdrop, but because we believe strongly, like you believe, that God never promised to bless us as we read our theological statements. As important as those statements are and as basic, and I think you here know how basic they are, but God promised to bless us as we read His Word. And the Holy Spirit will guide us into all truth. But we must give the Holy Spirit something to work with. And another item which I tell the students the first hour I have them is that personally, I came out of a non-Christian background. And one time I was reading that Isaiah 53 at home after meeting a Christian friend and hearing about the Bible and his working with me slowly over a long period of time. And I read that and I thought, now why did Jesus die? And then I thought, for me he died. And then I became involved in biblical reading. And as a university student, I couldn't put the Bible down. Someone said there are epistles, and I didn't know who in the world they were, but I soon found out, and prophets and other people. And as coming out of a non-biblical text, I soon became rather discouraged with a Christian culture, which I came in contact with, which took this Bible very lightly, and which discussed, which had all the right answers, but the Bible was somewhat of a hidden text for them. They had a lot of proof texts. They had many proof texts, and the Bible was more of a collection of verses rather than a dynamic whole within history. And so as I went to seminary, I became rather disillusioned at how people who talked about the Bible actually treated the Bible in action. And as I went to Israel as a student in 1960, my wife and I, we found that that Bible had an entire historical, cultural, geographical context which we never knew existed. So we went out to Africa. I was teaching out there. I came back to the Institute of Holy Land Studies in order to try to help that institution bring a program to people who could not come for our full year program or for what we had then, 2 years master's, first year at the Institute and second with the Hebrew University. We had fine graduate programs, but what could we take from the resources of that country to package in a program which could put into the mind, and I say the mind because it's not on the notebook, it's in the mind, a library of impressions which a person who would be working with the text could use as a frame of reference for the rest of his life. And as I was doing that, we came upon the idea of treating the program regionally. We've developed that into a nice syllabus, and I saw someone running around Jerusalem who was, I called the Mad Englishman. His name is Richard Cleave, and I use that very advisedly, the Mad Englishman, because this fellow was trying to capture the country on slides in a most dramatic way. So we decided to try to help him along and to refine his work, because we knew if we didn't do it, other people would do it who didn't have the same sincere regard for the text as we did. We've been working on that for a number of years. In fact, I personally stopped the project of taking slides until we could get the printed material ready so that the slides would fit into a printed form, a printed workbook with which the student could identify and it actually is an atlas which is uncompleted. The student must complete it. And as he completes it, he involves himself within what I call the playing board of biblical history. And as he's marking his map under direction and reading the text, he sees what's going on. It's something like, how many of you play Monopoly? Okay, some of you, I don't play Monopoly. Well, some of you, okay, it's not as popular here as it is in some parts of the world, but there are places on that board, Boardwalk. If I build 5 apartments in Boardwalk, or if I Park Street, and so forth, you'd know, if you knew the playing board, that I made a very dramatic move. And there are plenty of boardwalks and park streets and the strategic places in the country, and the biblical text is sort of built into that whole historical geographical context. Even archaeology can bring out this. I call it the sacred cow of biblical studies. Actually, it's helpful, but it's not an end the chief end, at least. So at any rate, with all due respect, we do a lot of archaeological work, so we're not sliding that at all, but I'm saying it has to be with geography, history, and archaeology. So with this fellow running around Jerusalem, we were able to cooperate with him. We're not bound in any official way, but we were able to produce over 3 or 4 years a student map manual, which I'm not here to sell or anything. I'm just here to tell you about it. And that is a rather dull set of maps, but with some very important basic information we'll see a little bit later, with a whole apparatus which guides you not only into the Old Testament periods, but into the Greco-Roman periods, with all of Josephus Flavius indexed topics, markings, which are being prepared now for that section. In other words, what we try to do is to take about 1,000 years of history, 500 BC, 500 AD, this is in the Second Temple, the Intertestament, New Testament part, after the Old Testament section, it comes two parts. Part A is Old Testament, part B is Intertestamental New Testament. I understand there's some New Testament people here, and I want to tell you that what we find to be helpful, in our long-term courses, provide 1,000 years of history, and then we drop the New Testament right in the middle of that. Paul is never the same. What he says about Jews and Gentiles, remember he left Caesarea just moments, so to speak, before the first revolt broke out, when things were smoldering in the country. All of that context of the New Testament is also here, plus a whole series on Jerusalem, and we'll look at them in a few minutes. Now, what the student does with that raw material is he marks his book, and I'll show you some slides in a moment. That's why we're sitting up here. They're not dramatic slides of I was going to say sunset. I didn't mean to say yours wasn't dramatic in terms of the wilderness. I could see what you're trying to capture there, but they're simply maps. Why? Because there are too many for me to go around and show you the individual maps. So I'd like to project it and show you. The student, after he is involved in the playing board, and with the players, and with part of the game, and he has the game board down, like Ken has now, what Ken needs after that, and I think he has the expertise here, and probably he's dug it out, if I know Ken, is to come back to a situation where he has a group of experts, like yourselves, the profs, who can then lead him through a chronological study, or a subject, or the prophets, or whatever your expertise is. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have a group of students sitting in front of you, if you're teaching the prophets, who knew their historical framework and their playing board, and then you pick up the prophet and everything he's saying in terms of the images he's using, the political, economic, military, geographical imagery, which is coming through in Isaiah, it's chock full of it, almost every page is that way. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you had these motivated students sort of churning at the bit to get into the text, what expertise you have could be used then on their behalf. Now, I want to tell you how. Not by coming to Israel to study at the Institute. We're happy for Ken who came, we hope others will come. I'm not here to try to drum up students to come to the Institute. We have 140 in January, 40 seminarians from Grace and Homer Kent and the whole gang from there, another 100 from various schools, and we're sort of tired. We have so many students. We're trying to actually sort them out now to take the best qualified ones. So we don't need students, although we're very happy when students come. What I would like to see, and this is the most serious thing I think I could say tonight, is that I would like to bring the land here to you. And I'd like to bring it, not personally, but give it to you, so you could have someone on campus. You have some very, very qualified people who are involved in this. I'm happy to find out from Ken and Dr. Keel's interest in this and other people, who could take this potentially explosive playing board, mark it, and provide a geographical, historical context to which the student, to which you could attach your expertise as profs, and then just the sky is the limit, because you can actually then go and use that which you have worked so diligently for so long and developed so many things with students who are right there with you. And the other thing I would like to say is a word of caution, which I have found why this is needed, because students coming to us fairly well across the board, we have from Westminster to Fuller to Trinity to Bethel to Gordon to 100 Wheaton College students come every summer. I find that the students who are coming have the right answers, but they are knowing less and less about the biblical text. And you have now gone into a period of the Great Commission emphasis. And I'd remind you, there are two parts of the Great Commission. One is preaching, terribly important. The other is teaching them to observe all things. You've probably heard that preached. I would imagine someone's touched on that. All we want to do is to help you give them the context of the scripture, which is the vehicle with which they can learn what is involved in that, teaching them to observe all things. Not to de-emphasize the other, but to raise the teaching and the biblical studies up to the level where it can be truly, they can exploit your expertise. Now, to do that, what we've done is we've produced a student map. This is the display version. I won't show you the other one, but a much smaller student map, which he can handle on his desk. A group of playing boards, and I'm preparing now the guide to how to mark them, which I'll show you in a moment. And Richard Cleave, in the meantime, this Englishman in Jerusalem, is back taking pictures and has expanded his project not only to include Israel, but to include Jordan and Israel, because those are wide open areas today with the stable situation. Iran, he was hoping to go as far as Alexander the Great went, the Indus River. Of course, Iran is question mark. Iraq, Syria is rather difficult to do anything in. So he's pulling together now Israel, Jordan, and Egypt, because those are really one package. And I want to show you some of the visuals. These are not his final form. These are widescreen slides, which we'll see in a moment. Because it means once the student has worked through his set of playing boards and has worked through the biblical text, remember, this is not an end. This is a means to an end. This is a catalyst, a motivational force. Then the student starts to say, where can I see this? I can't go to Israel. I don't have any money. Well, if we had, I'm happy for this screen, but if we had a room, a gymnasium, for instance, which had a massive wall on it, we could, through a widescreen slide, put a 50-foot or larger image on that wall and all of a sudden bring Israel here in a way which you could never, I have hardly ever seen it like that. I've flown at 13,000 feet with Richard. I've seen the country hundreds of times from some hill somewhere. And when I sit there, I always have to be careful because I'm ready to say, oh, if you could have only seen it last January 13th, where it was totally clear. Of course, I can't because, you know, all that does is make them feel that what they're seeing is not worthwhile. But if we can capture what was on January 13th in an optimum visibility and bring that to you where you can comfortably sit here and look at it, all of a sudden, the working on the playing board, the seeing the playing board, prepares the student in his mind and his spirit, his heart, his vision, to actually then start working through the text chronologically in historical, prophet, gospels, and what have you. So that's what we're involved in. We are a cog in the wheel. We're not an end. We're not the first thing I usually tell students in that first day is about the fact that we're not the center of the world. And that Israel is the country of Israel or Palestine or whatever you want to call it, is a way between, just a way to get from the big boys on both ends. And I've had seminary profs, I've had college profs who've argued me on that. They said, oh, no, that's the center of the world. And I tell them, it depends how you look at it. If you look at it from man's eyes, certainly not. I mean, you look at the Egyptian pillars, Egyptian monuments, Egyptian history, Assyrian history, and you look at our little history, it's nothing. If you look at it from God's eyes, God chose that land as a testing ground in time and space. And that testing is recorded for us in the scriptures. But that's God's perspective at a certain moment in history. It's now an example for us to look at, and it's the Word of God shows us how these people met their testing there, what God has wanted us to know, how he became involved in time and space. But it's not certainly the center of the world in terms of man's attention. And so all we'd like to show folks is this land between, give them a context, and then let the prof turn him loose with his students. And if we can do that right here at Concordia without even going out to the airport, much less getting on a plane and going to Israel, we will have felt that we are multiplying our resources here in a way which we could never, even if you'd all wanted to come to Jerusalem, you couldn't. And even if you could, we couldn't take you. And there are not the programs which could handle them, that many students. So therefore, all we can say is what we must do to get the job done, which we believe is the same job you're interested in, the Great Commission, is to bring what we can do to you so you can do it here. And we believe if you do that, there'll be those students who will want to come, and they'll be much better prepared when they do come. So not that, Ken, you weren't prepared, but I'd love to have you have gone through this before you came, and then you could have multiplied what you learned. Now, let's look at a few slides to show you how it works. Okay, I'll go rather quickly, and I don't want to put you through the agony of slides. I didn't bring one slide to this country. I went out in the sun and marked some maps, and took some student maps, and made them, got them in the sun. Excuse me, I'll just pull this a little bit more. There. And thereby I could actually, there we go. By doing that, I could actually take a picture and project it. So this is just pictures I took in Rockford, Illinois, just north of us here, and to try to show you a few things. This is an example of how you could mark a very dull map. You see the map up the top left-hand corner, and you should realize that our maps are oriented to the east. The top of the map is east. You say, oh no, I've learned everything differently. But actually, we have to do that because if we project the map on the wall, like the one I have pasted up on the wall here, there is no way we can put the country 50 feet across up and down. It must be width. And these aren't widescreen slides. These are just 35 millimeter, but you'll see widescreen just a little bit later. So it's, the top of the map is always east. We can discuss it later. I don't want to keep you longer than you have planned this evening. This is a dull map. It's the Egyptian expansion into Canaan in the 18th dynasty. You say, well, I won't come to Israel to learn about the 18th dynasty. Why in the world do I want to know about Egyptian history and a silly list sitting in Karnak, Egypt? Because that list shows you a priority which is behind almost every other part of ancient history. And our friend Thutmose III, the famous Egyptian pharaoh who came through this area, and you notice now we have highlighted his road. You see the yellow there? With some important names. The bottom right-hand corner is Gaza, then in the middle is Aphek, Megiddo, and so forth. And as we go a little further into the marking, I'll get a close-up in a moment, we put some blue arrows. Why blue? Blue is our color for our Gentile forces, so we know who's who. And you can see the priority of Egyptian history up the coast. We are trying to prove something, a coastal highway over to Megiddo, up from Megiddo, splitting into various areas. Remember, the student has put his markings on this map and is becoming acquainted with big power, what I call the cat, the cat's priorities in the country. If you look at a detail, we won't look at a detail. I took some out so we would be a little faster. If you look at a detail of Thutmose's campaign here, you come to a very boring map. The student opens, and he said, well, now, what in the world are we doing with this map? And then he starts to mark, and he puts on a few words. You see, this student has put on, he's not the best printer in the world, but you see he's put on a few brown names. These are names which are geographical names, so he knows the Sharon Plain, Jezreel Valley, Mount Carmel. The same uninteresting, dull map he just had. He's traced a road he's traced many times, and now he's seeing that road splits into three. He sees a small blue box, Yaham. This is where the pharaoh had to decide which road he will be going on. He had a war council. Now, why is this important? Because those three passes are the basis for, it's like our Suez Canal. It's the way through the country. The student is tracing those passes, and then he's going to put on the way the pharaoh chose to go through. And the great battle of Megiddo and what the other Canaanite powers did. Now remember, we are not learning history at this point. We are learning the playing board. And if our friend Thutmose III shows us something about the playing board which we can use in learning it, let's use him. We're not going to memorize his list. We're just simply using it as a convenient means of teaching the country. Another dull map. 5.4, detail of the entry into Canaan and the initial campaign. Joshua. You notice over to the right, the Dead Sea. You can see the Jordan River, Jericho. Of course, if you had your map in hand, it would be even closer. The student ends up with this. You see how he's put on the plains of Moab, River Jordan, Joshua's camp, the green arrow coming in. It's a much brighter green than it shows on the picture. The battle here in the Jordan Valley, the moving up, not on just any road across the white space, but on a particular ridge route coming up, discussing the text of Joshua's camp, the ambush, and so forth. For instance, do you know that within that same context, he could jump back to his map on Abraham and realize that the promise given to Abraham when he looked north, south, east, and west was given in almost the same region that Joshua won his first battle? Mere coincidence? Or has God kept his promise exactly where he gave it? Time has gone by, centuries. But it's interesting that it is in the same context. Over to the left, Ebal, Gerizim, the whole discussion of the reading of the law and so forth. The student, no one map is an end in itself. If you have children young enough or grandchildren, you know that the German game of Lego, building blocks. And if you have only 5 pieces of Lego, you can do only so much. But if you buy the child another bigger set, then that little set fits into the big set, and he can do 20 times more things. And if he gets the big set, the biggest set, he can do an endless amount of construction. That's what these maps are. Each is a building block, which if you start to play with it in a regional context, not only historical, regional, then you see what goes on. For instance, your New Testament folks. Here's 12.4, the four Gospels. The four Gospels do not have as their chief end the teaching of historical geography. What they say about it is right and true. This is demonstrated by this map. Even from not having the map right in front of you, you can see that most of the names here are black names, which are background names. Only the red names are the actual names from the Bible. I think maybe, Ken, if you could just focus here. I'm walking over myself here. This right here, that little button, if you could just focus that, then you can perhaps see, excuse me, here.
I can't see.
Okay. If you look at the red names, you see very few red names there. The New Testament does not give us the historical background, except in a very few places, like Luke 3:1 and so forth. I'm not saying that the text isn't historically correct. Of course it is. I'm saying that it is not giving us the greater historical context except in the few places where Luke brings it in. Where do we have to go to find the names of other places in the country? For instance, this place right here, if I can find it. Caesarea is not named in the Gospels, nor is Ptolemais, nor is Scythopolis, nor are most of the cities of the Decapolis. Did the Bible admit them? No, it takes for granted that you know the context. And where can you go to find that? Look at these red names. Don't worry that a little bit is off the map. These are the names from the first revolt. The names given to us by Josephus Flavius, that great historian. Is he more important than the Bible? Of course not. We're not saying that. What we are saying is he provides a historical, geographical settlement pattern which can be called into action to understand what are what's the greater context of the Gospels. For instance, here is a detail of the Sea of Galilee, one of the maps. I think you can see that most of the names are black. Where do they come from? Josephus Flavius, the contemporary historical background, from Talmudic names which are reflected back into this period because the Mishnah is talking about a situation of the first century, even though it's written later. And anything else, there's a hymn in the Jewish liturgy, which includes the names of villages to which the priests, after Jerusalem was destroyed in 70, went in Galilee. Why not call that in? Because these were actual villages existing in the time of the first, second century. Do you realize that that's the only other historical text which has Nazareth in it? Nazareth is mentioned nowhere else outside the New Testament except in that Jewish liturgical hymn. Piece of text was found, an archaeological fragment of an inscription which had part of that text written on it at Caesarea. So what we're calling into play is a very simple thing. It may sound insignificant, but you read in the Gospels that Jesus went through all the other villages of Galilee. Well, can you just make a map and put the New Testament with names, which are the red names here, Cana down here, Nazareth over there, Nain, Magdala. Does that represent the true picture of the context of the Gospels? Of course not. We have to call into action all of these other non-extra-biblical names, let's call them, and here they are, the context of the New Testament. How do we work with a student in using the primary sources, the actual text, okay, be it a historical biblical text or an extra-biblical text? Well, here is section 7. This is the apparatus, summary of contents and sources. On the left is a map. In the second column is the title of the map plus subtopics. And then over about in the middle is the primary sources. There is the breakdown of the biblical text, which has to do with that particular subject. Notice after that comes regional maps we'll talk about, Macmillan Bible Atlas. But a place for you as a teacher on the right to put an extra assignment in the class text. Write in, read such and such in dealing with Saul's beginnings and ends. Maybe you've written an article. Maybe there's something that you want particularly noted at that point. Over to the left, underneath the number, is a place for dates. Not that everything has to be filled in, but perhaps chronology at this particular point is important. And we follow the biblical order. Now, we know that Acheroni, other people, have what one of our students called the loose-leaf Bible. You just, pop out the one and put it in another place and try to reorganize the text. We were faced with a decision because we didn't particularly believe that, and we didn't want to be involved in that. So we chose to take the biblical order. While this was in preparation, a person who did not believe in the Bible was involved in the project. And that person, after Richard found out he didn't know much about the Bible actually in this setting, transferred the whole work over to us because of the fact that we took the Bible seriously. And I felt at that time, what would happen if this tool had come out and had given the total wrong impression of the Bible? This fellow wanted one map at Qumran, and then just talk about Qumran, how Jesus and John probably knew Qumran and this and that. All of this stuff, which is, we believe in Qumran as being a help, but it's not something which, as you know, you can simply, put everything in the same basket. It has to be used in a proper way. So we have worked out an apparatus which follows the biblical order and takes the Bible seriously. For instance, a little crooked, but that's okay. Look at Hezekiah, the very top in yellow. Notice, I know you can't read the entire text even behind the light, but that doesn't matter. Look at the primary source column. Not only do you have the 2 Kings 18, 1 through 8, the First Chronicles passage, the Second Chronicles passage, a bit from Isaiah, but you also have the inscription from Hezekiah's tunnel. And where can you read that inscription? You have A-N-E-T, Ancient Near Eastern Text, where a translation is available and the page number given. So if the student has these sources, extra-biblical sources, he can turn directly to the page, find the picture, and work with it. In other words, bringing everything in context. New Testament folks, I hope that someday in your busy curriculums, which are, I know, overloaded, you will be able to offer a course of Second Temple backgrounds, which will put the Acts or the Gospels, the New Testament material, in the context of the historical world. I mean, we should not pull it up. We are the people who talk about it being there, and yet sometimes we're the most guilty of pulling it out of that context and treating it as an isolated event. When Jesus stands in front of Pilate, when our Lord is of eternity is there in front of Pilate confronting this great Roman Empire, it's not just one moment. It's a whole series, it's centuries of buildup of Roman. It's the Punic Wars, it's Rome learning her lesson, it's Rome crushing pirates in North Turkey, it's Pompey's great march in, it's the revolt of the Jews during the time of the death of Herod the Great. It's coming down to this period, and we cannot isolate that text because Jesus is standing in a whole world, a Jewish, Greco-Roman world of various backgrounds. So we are attempting, even though we are limited to our little playing board in Palestine, we don't have maps outside because we couldn't find a map to do it justice outside, second edition we hope. But even at that, we have here a whole list of items which the person over there in the second column can read either in the Loeb edition or in the Whiston edition. And what I wish would come out is sort of a living Josephus type of thing, so people could actually read Josephus in a leisurely, enjoyable way. There's a lot of good material there to be excavated and used. Not as we use the Bible, but as a backdrop, so we can see the great drama being played, the backdrop of this drama. How do we attack this particular problem of the massive material for the student? One thing we did was to move the cross-reference of the biblical text, because that is primary in our mind, up to the beginning of the book, so you can actually look up Numbers 13 and find that it's treated in map 5.2, and if you go to the summary of that map in letter C, you'll see the subject, the primary text, and a lot of other information about it. So we've tried to use the biblical text to go right over to this line over here, which is just off, but that's okay, which is the actual topic of the map. Let's go through and look at a few things. We start out the book with a series, 16 maps in full color, which allow us to get in detail on all sites. I think I have a detail of this. Here it is. And you see Mount Carmel, for instance, but not just the geographical information. We have all Old Testament, Intertestament, New Testament, and late Roman Byzantine sites on one map with a set of modern roads. So as you come across this road, you're meeting not only archaeological sites and Byzantine sites, but also New Testament, Old Testament, Bronze Age sites. Everything imaginable is usable. It means in our field trips, we have now a modern road, a full geographical context, and a full statement of the sites so that we can actually work with them as we go. So for us, this is a very important series of 16 maps at the very beginning of the manual. Then we have an archaeological series. I see I put the first slide on. You may move this up slightly. Although that's okay, you won't mind. The first slide was not quite big enough, and I gauged it according to that, so I'm sorry. You can see this is not. The second set is an archaeological set of maps going from the Chalcolithic early bronze, showing you the latest material where important finds, the latest sites where important finds have been made. And these have been checked out right up to last summer. After you go through that, you can see Jerusalem, again, eastern-oriented, and you can see the modern city plan of the old city of Jerusalem with black. If you notice right in the middle is a black area. It's this over here. You notice the famous Avigad's Wall, which changed all theories which have been held for 100 years about Jerusalem, just was found 12 years ago. And then the projections from those known facts, various theories about, those are the red marks, they're broken actually. If we go to the Second Temple period of the time of our Lord, we can see that there are a number of theories. The first wall, well not so bad the first wall, but the second wall, the third wall, what some people call the fourth wall, which is, we feel, the third wall out here. These new excavations along here. All of the known material is there. And by the way, there's a large bibliography, which we have, it's an 800-piece bibliography, which for the last 150 years of Jerusalem, which in all languages, which has been pared down to 80, 90 select things, which will take you seriously into Jerusalem, also the Byzantine period. The great Cardo Maximus has been excavated. It was known to exist. It's been uncovered, the main street of Jerusalem in the Byzantine period. You don't see the detail. I have the slides. I left them out to save time. But I took a few slides to show you some detail. But before we go there, the last map after First Temple, Second Temple, Byzantine is to pull all of the known material from the first, second, and third maps and to put it on one map alone. And this map, as you see, is the key to major archaeological remains visible today. I wonder if we should put that today there. You know, that this was as of last year. And today, when they published a book and say the new atlas, which is new for about 1 year. So I wonder if we should have put the today there. But anyway, there it is. You can go on this map and look at any black part of it and get a key which will take you back to what that black part is, and then in Jerusalem you would walk on the plan of the modern city. You see the Turkish walls, the square, sort of, not the big square, but the general walls of Jerusalem, and we can lead our students right to any place and know exactly what's going on there. Now we have a display version, which I have posted on the wall, which has come out. I just want to show the display version because I can get my camera close enough to show you the detail, say, that of the Temple Mount, with the modern buildings and with other material, Second Temple material, Third Temple, the Ophel, David City, where the excavations are being carried out, with a whole series of numbers, which are, of course, keyed to the key. Mount Zion, there's the Institute of Holy Land Studies, I had to get our little plug in there, the new excavations out of the Protestant Cemetery, they're hidden by the light, but where a brand new late Roman Byzantine gate has been found, something very exciting. Or the, right, there's a number of things. Tombs, the best Iron Age tomb ever found was found last summer, and our students excavated it with one of our profs, and some startling remains there. Won't be published for a long time, but it's on the map already. At any rate, let's go to the index. The index, we felt it should be made not as a usual index, but a usable index. I know some indexes are very usable, but we wanted ours to be more usable than most are. We have over to the left a key number for our computer, this little red number. We have a grid, which is the grid concordance of the Palestine grid. We have the main name, usually the biblical name, and we have the Arabic name, so toponymic studies can be made. And the little column, the last little white column, is the number for the Encyclopedia of Archaeological Excavations. The new work just come out, 4 volume, very fine, lots of mistakes actually in it, but it's very useful. Always wait till the second edition if anything comes out, you know. Hopefully they're corrected. But we have gone through not only their index, but every page to pull out every possible reference. Then we have archaeological periods, historical periods, and you can see, for instance, where the first yellow line is, right up here, that's Bethel. And look at the line of Bethel archaeologically, and look at it historically, and the rest of that line, where it shows up as a primary source name in the text, where it shows up as a background name. And I believe you can see that you can start even to explore the history of Bethel just from that one line there. Be a useful index not only to find material, which map it's on, but to see the total context right across the page as a primary and a background site. A few slides, and I want to do this rather quickly. In fact, maybe I'll go through them just quickly because I want to show some widescreen to show you the larger context. The problem is, once the atlas is published, it's not complete because the student must complete it, and profs don't have time to take to complete it and work out a system. Richard Cleave said, I do not want to impose my system on any school or prof. All I want to do is to give them the raw material. I told him there's very few profs across the United States who could actually use it because they haven't had time. They're busy people to develop this new tool. Can we just move it back? I think it'll move in the middle now. So I decided to set about doing this while I was back in the States this fall. And what I've actually done, that's okay, just thought, yeah, that's, you move up a little bit more. Yeah, just I thought it wasn't quite in the middle. A little schematic. You notice the road, the main yellow road going through the country? We're going to teach that road as a background to studies in Galilee up here, in Samaria and Judah. And that main road, I just want to show you what, this is a little demonstration of what the first chapter of the guide is. The guide is how to mark part A, the Old Testament part. The New Testament, Intertestament will be done next spring. The student has to learn basics first. You have to learn your ABCs. And the ABCs is that road right along there. And how are we going to learn that ABC? We're going to take 1,000 years of history, and we are going to put pick out the maps in that 1,000 years of history between 1500 BC over here and 500 BC, because it's where most of the action is, pick out maps. We're going to pick out one Egyptian map down here from the 18th dynasty. Shows that main road we just saw in yellow. We're going to pick out another one, Seti, here. We're going to pick out Canaanite centers. We're going to pick out Solomon and David. And then we're going to pick out the Assyrians and Tiglath-Pileser. All of five of these maps show the main route. And let's just click through them. The student sees Egyptian priorities in the country. They're very clear. The line coming up, he hasn't read the whole list, but he knows that's where the cat wants to go through. If he goes through, that's our Suez Canal. That's the way to get through the country. And as he goes ahead, he sees that Egyptian priorities were the same way in the 13th century. Same road, sites showing up all throughout the 13th century, which show the priority that main road has. Remember, we are not teaching history. We're teaching the main road as the ABCs before we get into the regional studies. We see Canaanite centers along those roads, which the Israelites could not take. And therefore, if they could not take them, they did not have control of the main road, and their economic prosperity had to be delayed until Solomon, as David and Solomon came along and took them. The minute David took this area, The minute David came along and took the area, Solomon, his son, built along that same road. You see the three ones behind the lamp, if it doesn't matter. Gezer, Megiddo, Hazor. 1 Kings 9, terribly important. If you don't understand 1 Kings 9 and what Solomon did, you cannot understand the prosperity. And that prosperity which brought all of the trade and here that comes and all of the arrows back to Jerusalem, even trade with Phoenicia and so forth. Remember, we are not teaching history. We're showing how that main road demonstrated the history of that main road shows us it's important politically, militarily, economically, because that is going to be the background for all of our other ancient history maps. I know it's hard for you to see now if you don't know the country, but if you would see the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth chapter and how it builds on this main road, you'd see, well, of course, you have to learn the ABCs before you start spelling cat. Okay? Here's another dull map. What a thrilling map this is. We've left the thrill up to the students. In the days of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser. And here he comes down the main road to stop Egypt. Here he comes to take Galilee, to take Gilead, to take control of the main road of the whole country. And what is the poor northern kingdom left with when they're all through? There it is. Restricted. Its economic, political, military base taken away from it. And the whole teaching of Isaiah, the land which sits in darkness has seen a great light, the land of the Galilee of the nations. Read Isaiah 9:1. Powerful. I've had students, I've been in tears sometimes. They don't know about it. As you sit on the top of that cliff, Arbel, and read this text, and read Isaiah, and see what he's saying about this land which sits in darkness, and the destruction, and the tears, and the forlorn situation of Isaiah's world with the expanse of the Assyrian Empire. And then get down to that verse, but watch out, for a son is born, okay? To us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his reign shall be forever, and he shall be called, among other things, Tsar Shalom, the Prince of Peace. What words to say when this map was going on. You can never read that again without a lump in your throat. It's a thrill, because you realize this is hope. This is the gospel, okay? And the same as in our world today. And Isaiah is this prophet of despair sometimes because of the situation he's in, but never despair without hope, never the real situation without the hope of promise. So we're trying to give the student that. After the student finishes that, he looks at his map. I'm sorry, I just took it out, couldn't get the creases out quick enough, but this is how the student sees it. And he looks at his map and he says, wow, I've gone over that road five times. And I now would like to see what it looks like. And we have a map in full color, which he can put in this table, and start to, we call it Daniel Boone, excuse me here. He starts from Gaza, Aphek, Megiddo, Hazor. He starts to explore that himself and discover the path. We don't have to tell him where it is. He knows Megiddo. He says to himself, hopefully, I've gone across that mountain about 5 times already. I've marked it across history. And there it is. That's the path. Then, and I'll show you the detail. Here's the Philistian plain. He gets up to the pass over here, going over to Megiddo. He discovers the pass for himself. He looks at his map and sees how to get from Megiddo at the bottom right-hand corner to Hazor, the top left-hand corner. All of the problems. Then is when Richard Cleave's visuals come into play, because then we can sit down in a room like this and bring Israel to him right here, now, without waiting, without the frustration of coming over and leaving your children back here or your wife back here or what have you. Okay? Or he can pull up his detailed regional map and look at the modern situation in terms of modern roads and all of the ancient sites. In other words, as we go traveling, he can see it there. But even if he sits here, he can see details of the swamp, details of Hazor. At any rate, after that, he has, and here is where I would like to throw on the widescreen, just to show you, these are not pictures which are in a final form. They are a few pictures I found in a warehouse in New Hampshire, excuse me. I just have to move back. Ken could, what you do here, I thought I would be here, is that you push this in, and when you push it in, see when it's out again, you turn that one click and then push again. So let's start back here, okay? Now could we move it back slightly? Okay, a little bit more. Oops, I made a piece of tape right there, a little bit more. Now we could focus. I think it's in focus already. I took this map out in the sun just to show you what we're going to be doing. We have worked with that student through a main road. We have used history to illustrate that main road. Now the student, and he's explored his own map, to in his own mind, construct that road on the map. Now we have him primed. We've caught him. Because now that student is telling us, I'd like to see what it looks like. And this is where Richard Cleave comes in. Now, not 5 years ago, where he wouldn't have had this written context, which would prime the student. Now the student, he can tie his lectures into specific details of the topography, which now we're working on. I'm working on very, very hard to keep the aesthetics nice, of course, but to make the teaching impact a powerful tool which can be used after the student has worked through the material himself. For instance, we're going to start from Mount Hermon. The student, if you have been a student, you have worked through this road many, many times, 5 times, but for you it seems like 100 times, because you've marked it, you looked at, you found the site, you found Hazor, you found Megiddo. I'd like to show you what the Golan Heights looks like. I'd like to show you the region of Dan. I'd like to show you these swamps, this River Jordan down to the Sea of Galilee, what the area below the Sea of Galilee looks like. Then to take you from Hazor around here, through those mountains which you've explored on your own. So let's go to the next slide, and I'll just show you. Now, would you, no, you have to turn the little red button one slide when it's out. Wait, pull it out. Ah, you're way ahead of me. Okay, I'm looking in the projector, and it's looking right at me. Let's start at the top of Mount Hermon, almost to the top. Richard went up here, got up on the top, got his way through some security things, went out on 3 feet of snow and an icy crust above a minefield between Syria and Jordan, and took pictures. And the Israeli army almost threw him in jail, and he played the dumb Englishman, which he's very good at playing. And he got his pictures, and he has it. But he jeopardized his life to get up there to take it. This is totally classified, but nothing, he never takes anything, which is military. So once they see this fellow just taking some nice, beautiful pictures, he wants Mount Hermon to show you what 9,000-foot Mount Hermon near the top looks like. Okay, then from looking behind us now, the next picture. We look out over that Golan Heights, and we see, this is what he saw as the sun was coming up. Syria is to the left. We're looking south. Here are these volcanic cones. There is Syria. Here is Israel in the occupied territory there. You can see this great battlefield across which many, many armies have gone. Way over here, and I'm sorry to walk in front of you, the Sea of Galilee and the Hula Basin. Let's go to the next one. Let's go down to the Golan. Remember, these are Richard's pictures, but they're not in the order which they will be. I just chose a few out to show you. Here's what the Golan looks like. Maybe the old Stone Age dolmens over there would interest you. But the flat area with Mount Hermon to the right, behind. Next picture, and we'll see. Mount Hermon up there to the right, and this is a modern settlement, which many, it's an Israeli settlement, but many Israelis are upset at these religious folk up here. You know, Israel is not monolithic in any degree. They usually tell you you have two Jews, you have three opinions, and they're always fighting, and this is one of the places. But at any rate, you can get a feeling for the Golan and for the security, which it is, a security problem is posing today. At any rate, let's go back. You see Mount Hermon up there? We're going to go up the top again, okay? And as we do, let's look out now on that Hula Basin. You have marked it. You have worked with it, okay? You can see out here in the middle of it, this area, the swamp and the area, the hills of Galilee across there. We're not going to go across it because it's very difficult to go across it. Let's go down into that basin, which you've heard about because you've been studying your map. Remember, you're not quite prepared, but had you been prepared, this would be an exciting picture because you're coming down into the basin. Do you know the tribe of Dan had such a hard time with the Philistines, they moved out, and they moved right up here? And they said, we don't need anything now. We're perfectly secure. The Lord made a mistake. He put us down there, but we found a better place. What they didn't know is there was no cat when they moved up there. And as soon as the cat came up again over at Mount Hermon, in the even earlier, when one of the what I call the mice, the smaller powers on the playing board, the mice play when the cat's away. Even Syria crushed Dan. But when Assyria came along, the entire area was taken into captivity. They moved from the frying pan into the fire. This is the traditional entrance into the entire northern area of Israel. We can demonstrate it time and time again. And isn't it interesting? I personally believe that Mount Hermon is the Mount of the Transfiguration because it's in the area of Caesarea Philippi, and that is the context of Matthew 16. In the district of Caesarea Philippi, he went up to a high mountain. And when he came down, do you know what words he said, which I feel it was right down here, in this, as ancient armies ran down here, as they took the area of Dan, they didn't go over the Galilean mountains and right down to Hazor, the base of those mountains, taking all the kingdoms of the world, marching toward Egypt. Do you know what Jesus said in this context? Even if you do gain the whole world, what does it profit you? So he's not saying it anywhere. He's saying it here, at this particular place, which is a terribly exciting context for those words, because indeed everyone who came through had done that and had lost ultimately. And you know what he told the disciples right after that? I'm going to Jerusalem and I'm going to die on the cross. He says, oh, no, you're not. And this whole context is the attitude Jesus had at these moments, looking at the history, looking at his mission and the attitude of kingdom building which the disciples had. And he had to carry not only the cross of Calvary, but the cross of a nationalism which the disciples had, which as he went in the way of the cross, even into Capernaum, he said, what are you talking about? Oh, nothing, Lord, really nothing. I know what you're talking about. Who's going to be the greatest? He's marching up to Jerusalem. And while he's going along, Mrs. Zebedee comes up. Do you have a place for one of my boys? One on the right, one on the left. And he's on the way to bear the sins of the world, the Lamb of God. Where does he start that way of the cross? Not in Jerusalem. Of course, it's eternity, we know. But in the land, his first prediction is right here, where all ancient, where we've seen the Egyptians, the Assyrians, everyone else come through. This is no mistake. Jesus picks the spots. His itineraries have an Old Testament centrality, which is beyond your understanding, unless you can actually see the places where he says these things and what his mind pulls together in terms of what the biblical historical relevance of the place is. We don't build castles out of nothing. I believe these are real things. They are. John is full of it. Other people in Samaria, the whole Jesus at the well of Samaria is actually talking. He's gone by Jeremiah's village. Jeremiah's talked about water. What is Jesus talking about? Water. There's a number of places in the Gospels which the best commentary on the text is the area through which Jesus has just walked, what's happened there and what the prophets have said, because it's right in his right in his words. It's obvious. Anyway, we're going to go down into there, and we'll just have a couple of slides and show you. We're going to look back at the mount we just came down on the right, Mount Hermon. There is Caesarea Philippi, in the district of Caesarea Philippi, that magical place where the water comes right out of the ground, the god Panius. Do you know that in the Second Temple period, the great Seleucid Empire around 200 BC took the entire country by taking that site in the middle of the right-hand picture, Panius, the great battle when the Seleucid Empire took over the country from the Ptolemies, from the Egyptians? It didn't happen just somewhere. It happened right there. And in the time of the New Testament, there was a temple built there to the Caesar. So it's a very exciting place, extra-biblically. And, of course, the biblical context jumps alive when you see the total context. Next slide, we'll jump back a little further in our airplane. And we can see now Mount Hermon way up here. We can see Caesarea Philippi. And right next door, Dan. There is a close-up of the tell. The archaeological material, be it the high place which has been found or the great wall city, they have now found a middle bronze gate which they appear to have encased in. They weren't satisfied with it, so they built a big ramp over it, and they have preserved a standing arch of the middle bronze period. It was something never found before in the country. A lot of exciting goodies down there when we bring the artifacts, the coins, the inscription to the god. Was Dan used as a name in the New Testament? In the post-New Testament period, here's an inscription to the gods which are at Dan. And so Dan was a lively city called Dan in the time of the New Testament. At any rate, let's jump down and see the river coming right out, another river. And as it comes right out, you can get the feeling for this the marvelous flowing of water. What, perhaps, now maybe you may feel I'm stretching a little bit, but a Jewish rabbinical mind certainly pulls everything out of the immediate context and puts it in a sort of like a little computer. And you know what would ring a bell if you were a Jewish fellow up here and you knew your Bible and you worked with it? When you see these things, all my billows have gone over me. From Hermon I cry out. I remember I remember the feast. I remember going up to the temple. Okay, Psalm 40, Psalm 42, 43. And what are the words of that? What shall I say when they say to me, where is your God? Why are you discouraged, O my soul? Why are you so nervous? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him who is the strength of my countenance. And these billows going over you, Mount Hermon, this whole region cries out in that text. And I wouldn't be surprised, and this is going maybe a little too far, if this psalm wasn't part of what Jesus was thinking about in this region as he set his face toward Jerusalem. Again, I don't want to say this is this, but I say it's interesting to think about at least, because Jerusalem is there, Mount Hermon is there, the discouragement is there. Where is your God? Remember what they said on the cross to Jesus. Where is your God? So I believe there are some nuances there. We can't say it's one-to-one, but it certainly broadens our vision of possibilities. We go beyond, we go down, and we'll go quickly through to let you go now, the Hula Basin. We're up in Upper Galilee now. There are our Golan Heights. The water's been put into fish ponds. It was a swampy area. The student wants to see what the swamp looked like. So let's fly over the swamp out there, the next picture, and show him the right side where the swamps have been preserved. Most have been drained. We got the Israeli map makers to put the swamps back in after they drained them in 51. They didn't like that, but we have them back. Mille Kula has been recreated on our maps now. Here's a detail with the papyrus groves. You see, as a student, that is not a place you're going to lead your army through. Therefore, the road which hugs the mountain, which you've traced so carefully, avoiding those swamps, becomes a reality. As we see the Jordan River flow out of these swamps in the next picture, we'll take the Jordan River right on through a cut. And here we're looking south, the Jordan River going right down to the Sea of Galilee, cutting through this basaltic dam, a great basaltic area. You can see in the right side of the picture, as we look the opposite direction to the north, we see the Jordan River flowing toward us in the right picture, flowing out into the sea by the village of Bethsaida, the village of the fishing village, actually. Where that is, if it's on the shore, if it's a great tell up on the plain, not quite known. We have two sites with question marks there. But we go ahead and we come out to the actual, well, we see the river, we get down to the ground so we can see what the river does as it cuts through this area, where most of Jesus' teaching took place, by the way. on these mountains, right between the Swans and the Sea of Galilee. And it then goes out into the sea, and we come out to the sea, and of course the boat and the whole bit, we're not going to, you know. Richard is great on aesthetics. He always tells me, "You're fighting me on aesthetics." I says, "Yes, because I want content. I don't want to feel good." There's enough people in the world who feel good already. And you know, we may think we won the battle with the New Orthodox. I'll challenge you tonight, we have not won the battle with the New Orthodox. Even though we have kept our theology, what's happening in our churches? It's not what the text says, it's what we feel the text says. And when you come to a Bible study, in many churches I see, the Bible is a calling card. It puts you in the club. You open the Bible, you read a text, and then you all talk about what you think, how you feel about it. And that's pre-Reformation technique. The text stands, no matter what we feel about it, the text is there. So I would challenge you tonight that be careful not to think we've won the battle. We may have won it theologically, we may have won it otherwise, but in action we may be losing. Our people may be... it may be becoming the Word of God to them as they read it, and that's not what we say. We say it is the Word of God. So aesthetically, we like to show nice pictures, but we're working on Richard to keep the content there. For instance, we're looking from the Golan Heights. There is the Sea of Galilee, our road clear across the sea in the right-hand side of the picture, moving up to Mount Tabor here and over the Jezreel Valley. And the next picture, if you watch this southern end of the sea, you can see the whole Jordan Valley. There, see the right of the picture, the sea, and look at the Jordan Valley. We don't have time, but had you these slides here with the side of a gymnasium wall, much larger, and had you students who had worked through these maps, you could actually bring the context to them here and then start to work with it. So one more picture, just the Jordan Valley. We have a number of pictures, but I don't think we'll go ahead as the Jordan flows down south. Of course, it becomes an obstacle. But let's leave it there, because I want to, if some of you want to stay around and see some more, fine. But, you know, of the showing of slides, there is no end. And so the eye is never filled with seeing, nor the ear of hearing. So we don't want to take time. Just one quick word, and that is that what we're doing is we have finished the printed part of the material. We are now in the final production of the visual part of the material in a canned operation. In other words, the music is there, the slides are there, it's putting it together. Do you know the last part of the whole operation? And this may excite you. Do you know that you store slides today, you can store them electronically? You don't have to store them on film anymore? You know videotapes, don't you? You know the tape is on its way out, now they have discs. And you know what you can store on one disc? 17,000 visuals on one disc, with a laser beam running over the top. We are working on a computer now to take all of the 35 millimeters, all the plans, coins, the artifacts, visuals, aerials, ground shots, everything, and put them, we're not putting them on a disc now, we're putting them in a computer, so that in 5, 6, 7, 8 years hence, when the price of that video disc comes down, we can just put it all electronically on a disc. And it means if you want to phone up a computer here, or you have one at Concordia, you're teaching Palestinian backgrounds in the 11th century BC, you want to see city gates, you type it in and it comes out. No starting of slides. Okay? Do you know what that means, to have every visual possibility at your fingertips? I know it sounds, you know, incredible. It is. But it will come. Not in the 5, 6, 7, maybe 7, 8 years. But we're preparing now so that not only the printed materials, not only the widescreen slide, which will show you the country, but the archive of up to how many thousand slides we want, we can have. And you can have them all here. So I'd like to, you know, see Concordia in 5, 6 years being able to use this. That's why I'm here. Not to bring students to the Institute, which I'd love to do. We'd love to have Ken, we'd love to have all of you. But to have you use it here so that you can have it right in your backyard, so to speak. So, thanks a lot. A little over time here, so sorry. Yeah.